You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. It is 7:21 here on the west coast of the United States of America, and this thing has taken a while to put together. I don't know. It's amazing when people retire how they get busier in their retired life than they do when they're actually working legitimately for a living. But I guess it happens. It's amazing to me. So joining me is Bob Milstead. And Bob, first of all... First of all, Bob, thanks for doing this. So you're Broomer your whole life. Now you're Bob. How does that work?
Yeah, I knew you'd start off with that. You know, I mean, so you know, just tell everybody. I mean, you call, and I don't answer the phone. You know, you expect me to be there at your beck and call. You call, and
yes,
my voicemail says, "Hi, this is Bob Milstead." And so when I get out of the gym, there's this voice message from you, and you're just busting my balls hard about Bob. Where's this Bob come from? You know, so I figured you'd probably tee this off with Bob.
I thought I had the wrong number. In my own defense, like, what? It's like finding out.
Get to it, Mac. Get to it.
It's like finding out John Wayne's real name is Marion. What?
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that.
What?
Yeah.
Marion? That doesn't work for me, okay?
No.
So, anyway, First of all, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it, and I've been looking forward to it. We first met in 1989 at the basic school, and it was a group of young officers there, really, that would go on and do great things in the Marine Corps. But unbeknownst to us, we were just jackass captains. Bob,
majors.
Bob was a major.
Quit calling me Bob.
So we meet, and so these are the kind of guys that are there. John Kelly's a major, who's now Department of Homeland Security. He's, running IOC. And then you have future commandant of the Marine Corps in command and leadership, and, Lieutenant Colonel Tamer Amos. And then his sidekick is Boomer Milstead. And so the aviators held down the leadership department. And then Boomer went to command, what, two companies at the basic school?
Yeah.
And
Elvis and Alpha.
Elvis Company, which was funny. So that's where we meet. But Generals Furness, General Kennedy, Clarity, Craparotta, Osterman, who am I leaving out?
Yeah, and then just a ship pot full of colonels.
Oh.
I mean, guys that went on, did 30 years, you know, P.E. Smith, guys like those guys. You know,
smart guys. And really it was a time, kind of an intellectual renaissance for the Marine Corps in terms of General Gray, who I don't think gets enough credit for breathing intellectual life back into the Marine Corps. But, you know, what is this whole maneuver warfare thing? And we hear about the Germans all the time, but how did they do it? Because, you know, it doesn't sound like everybody can go skip and go naked and make their own decisions out there. I mean, as much as people are talking about that, the Germans don't, you know, Colonel Klink doesn't seem to be that guy with me. Now, I don't know that, you know, I know Hogan's Heroes is not really probably where I should get my intellectual capital relative to German maneuver warfare, but he just didn't seem like, you know, that kind of guy. So that's what we were doing. We were writing and arguing and discussing, and so that's we met at the basic school, as so many people who have been on this program talk about. But before we talk about that, we got to talk about you there, Boomer. So born and raised where?
Well, you know, I moved around. I was born in San Antonio. I was born at Fort Sam Houston when my dad was going through OCS. He was in the Air Force. And so, you know, and then I moved around my whole life.
You're that kid?
Yeah.
Your dad's
born in Fort Sam Houston. My dad's in OCS. And then he ends up sticking around the Air Force and does like 27 years, 26 years, something like that. And I moved all around. So, you know, lived in England, lived in Florida. I graduated from high school in Taiwan.
Of all the places you spent growing up, is there one place that you, when you think of, that you call home?
No.
No? What about, did you have a favorite place that you lived growing up?
Yeah, Florida, Cocoa Beach, because that's where I started surfing. And you know me, I've been surfing ever since. I've been surfing over 50 years.
You're kind of a big guy to be a surfer, though.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's okay.
But Cocoa Beach was fun, but then I got pulled out of there, you know, and that was in the formative times. You know, you're 8th and 9th grade, you know, you're playing a little football, you're on the beach, you're hanging out with girls, and then I get pulled out of there, I get taken up to Norfolk. My dad's going to the Armed Forces Staff College for 6 months, and then I'm off to Taiwan, you know. So, you know, many, many kids, dependent kids, that's what they do. You learn resiliency because you're always on the move. You got to be able to make friends, you know, it wasn't bad.
So you're an Air Force kid?
Yeah, Air Force brat. Yeah, so, you know, the story of ending up in the Marine Corps is pretty interesting.
Yeah, so you're that kid that, you know, all you want to do is tweak your dad, like, oh, Air Force, how far can I get away from the Air Force?
I always wanted to fly, you know. I wanted to fly. I loved airplanes. I was around airplanes. My dad was a pilot, you know.
What'd your dad fly?
He flew, all kinds of stuff. He flew that old SA-16, the Albatross for a while. He flew T-33 jets. He ended up being a big 130 guy, flying in 130, you know, flying in TAC and MAC as they were bouncing back and forth the 130 community. So he's a lot of 130 time and stuff like that. I wanted to fly. That's what I knew. I wanted to fly. At first I looked at the Air Force. I wasn't interested in any academies, and truth be told, you know, I was pretty much of a punk in high school, and my grades wouldn't have gotten me within shouting distance of an academy. So I just went to school, but I always had it kind of on the radar, you know. Hey,
you want to fly. Okay, but you can fly in all four different services, and you can fly in the Coast Guard. So there's a lot of different ways you can fly. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
So this is it. I mean, nothing happens. Nothing happens in this world by mistake. You know, I mean, so.
You're going to sell me this cosmic linkage right now?
Yeah, be quiet.
Wow.
And let me tell you the story. So, I want to fly, but I'm not serious.
Wait a minute. Did you just tell me to be quiet on my own show?
I
don't know. This is unbelievable.
I want to fly. But I keep on pushing it off. I'm not serious enough to look at any real programs, you know. So I get somewhere around beginning of senior year, you know. I'm involved in this Navy program. I've applied to this Navy program. It was called AVROC, and it was basically, you know, you'd go. It's kind of like a PLC for aviation in the Navy, I guess.
Okay.
And but I never really, you know, did that. So I'm. This is my senior year, Mac. I graduated in August, and so this is, I think, in late July. I'm walking back from the Navy office after seeing them and finishing up some of the forms, and I'm walking by the federal courthouse in Houston. And out in front of the federal courthouse in Houston, there's this sign, and it's, you know, those kinds that were on the springs, you know, that, you know, back and forth in the wind.
Had
a picture of a guy in a flight suit holding a helmet. A flight helmet. It said the Marines are looking for a few good men, and then on the bottom to fly. And I'm like, well, shit, I didn't know the Marines had aviation. You know, I got to see what this is all about. So I walk into the OSO office, you know, office traffic. And the guy, you know, the captain, he starts talking to me. I think his name was Captain Turner. He's like, so, you know, and this was 1974. So, you know, the Marine Corps is having, we're in still some difficult times here. You know, they're trying to get, you know, their stuff together. And so he starts asking me questions. So you're getting ready to graduate from college? Whoa, okay, that's a check. You know, your physical, you look like you're in physical shape. Okay, you know, what's your grade point average? I said, it's going to be somewhere around a 3.2 or a 3.1. I mean, nothing to shout out, okay? How old are you? I said, I'm 22. He says, so when were you born? I said, the 10th of November, 1951. Whoa, you were born on the 10th of November? I said, yeah. He goes, this is supposed to be. and I bit. And you know, the curtains opened, and the music began, and the angels descended, and he started talking about this. Well, I'm not sure you can cut it. And, you know, oh, you know, I took that hook, and I started diving deep, you know. And he's like, you know, whoa, we got us one. And that night I went home and called my dad and said, I'm joining the Marine Corps. He's like, you know, you're what? I said,
what?
Yeah, I'm going to join the Marine Corps. He said, where the hell did that come from? I said, you know. I'm going to join the Marines.
Did you tell him? I saw a sign on the interstate.
I told him the whole story. He started laughing, you know, and we talked about flying and everything. So my dad was always, my folks were very supportive and everything, you know. So to make a long story short, you know, I began the paperwork and all that other stuff and then graduated from college, and that was in August. And in January, I started OCS in Quantico. Freaking
wow.
Snowing. Yeah. And we were in those old barracks off by the railroad track, you know. They're not there anymore.
No, I got up and tried to run out of there the first night when the train came in my sleep.
Yeah.
I don't even remember it. But what's really funny is the more guys I interview, it's however the Marine Corps gets on the radar. You know, sometimes it's a trip into the cafeteria back in the day, or it's standing next to a recruiting table. They meet Marines, and they see them in their uniform. And do you remember that PX Kelly poster? He was standing there in his Charlies
with his hands on his hips.
Hands on his hips. And
yeah.
PX Kelly had some corn, man. He had a few rows of ribbons.
He had a rack.
He had a rack. And he's standing there looking at the camera. You're the court. But it's true. People look at that, and they say, who have no idea. And they're like, who are those guys? Oh, those are Marines. I want to talk to them. And it appeals just that look. And I have I didn't know that. I have a son born on November 10th, too.
I mean, it's, and now, you know, I tell people, you know, as I was going through the Marine Corps, you know, my birthday was the 10th of November. People laugh, you know, but I rolled it into a thing when I would speak. I'd say, you know, hey, look, my mother brought me into the world on the 10th of November, but I was not born until the 6th of January, 1975, when Staff Sergeant Harrison got his hands on me.
Oh, my God.
You know, I think he eventually warmed up to me, but at first he accused me of being a Russian spy sent here to fuck up his Marine Corps.
Can I
say that on the radio?
I think you just... No, look, we're... this is all Marine radio. It's not like normal radio. Okay, it's dysfunctional.
My wife listens to this. She's going to say, I don't believe you dropped the F-bomb.
I know.
You weren't even into this.
Yeah, exactly. How about warming up to it, Bob? did she call you Bob or Boomer?
No, she calls me Bob. She calls me Honey.
That is sweet. You know, your wife and I have a long relationship, by the way, just so you know. I've sent her messages from Afghanistan. I know her from Quantico.
Yeah.
So we go way back. My son, I remember looking at him, his older brother, who's now at the basic school instructing, Captain John McNamara. When he joined the Marine Corps, I looked at his younger brother and I said, you know, John had a choice. You know, you don't.
Yeah.
He said,
so the one that's with 3-5, the lieutenant with 3-5,
yep.
He's born on the 10th of November.
November 10th.
Sweet.
And when he came out, actually, Susan was in labor, and the doctor looks at me and he says, so, Dad, you know if it's going to be a boy or a girl? And I said, and we're Bethesda. Doc, in fact, Patrick would have been born on the 495, except that Friday in 1989 was the federal holiday. And were it not for that, we'd have been stuck in traffic. He'd have been born.
Because you were smoking along.
Come on, the Beltway at 6:30 in the morning. You know, on any day of the week, you're going nowhere. Patrick would have been born on the side of the Beltway in a Pathfinder. Yeah, black, nice Pathfinder. that I buried in the training areas of Quantico many, many times. Anyway, but the doctor looks at me and he goes, "Dad, so do you know it's boy or girl?" I said, "Doc, you know what day today is?" He said, "Friday." I said, "No. Today's a Marine Corps birthday. Do you think this woman's going to give me a girl today? This is going to be a man, Patrick Francis." And he looks at me like, "You're an idiot." And, right, and he goes back to the task at hand. So Patrick comes out and he looks at me and he says, "It's a boy."
He says, "He's got a kickstand."
I put my arms in the air and I said, "I told you." And he looks at me and goes, "You Marines, man, where did God get you from?" And, but I remember telling Patrick, I said, "Look, I said, do you want to be the family pussy?" He said,
"Well, you know, it would have been great. I mean, you could have had a daughter born on the 10th of November, and you'd have named her Marina Cora, you know, and she could have gone on and joined the Marine Corps today and been a success.
You'd be proud. You're absolutely right. That could have happened.
Yes, but it didn't.
It did not. And so, no. Patrick. Kilo.
Yeah, I have a daughter. Our oldest daughter had a daughter, and her name is Cora, C-O-R-A. But, you had to name her Marina Cora. They're like, "That's the joke. You know, Dad, come on. You know, we're not naming any of our daughters Marina Cora."
So you joined the Marine Corps and...
Never thought about being a Marine. Wasn't one of those kids that had posters, you know, my life I want to be a Marine Corps. Never gave it a second thought, you know, and just almost arbitrarily, you know, wow. And gotten that, you know, 1964 pickup truck I had and pulled out of the driveway and drove away. And my brother likes to say he was standing there with my dad and he said, you know, he'll be back in a couple of months. And he says he came back 40 years later, you know. And then, you know, began the transformation. And as you know, it's a no kidding transformation. You know, I mean, the Marine Corps taught me and made me who I became.
My guest this morning, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Boomer Milstead. And so let's talk about your career a little bit. How do you get pointed towards Cobras? How does that all work out?
We go down. I want to fly, you know, and so we're at OCS, and they take us down to OCS. While we're in OCS, they would take us down in groups of three or four. They'd march us down from OCS to the air station there, and there was a guy there that had a T-28, and they take us up on an orientation flight, you know, just to kind of keep you motivated while you're going through OCS.
Really?
You know? Yeah, yeah. So we went out, you know, and as we go down there, there was like four Cobras there, and I'm like, holy shit, those are bad looking. You know, and they got the 20 millimeters sticking out from there. J model Cobras.
Right.
And so that kind of got me going. And then as I started, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, all about the Marine Corps and the combat arms and the, you know, I was like, you know, it's Cobras because you're down there close. You're very much involved. You know, and so when I went off to flight school, I wanted to be a Cobra guy. You know, and I was blessed. I ended up where I was.
So you're just not making that story up because you weren't good enough to get jets.
No,
because
no,
you know how that normally works. Everybody wants to be a jet guy.
You wanted to fly what you got. No, no, that's not the case. You know, I wanted to be a Cobra guy. As a matter of fact, you know, we could talk a little bit about the basic school in a minute. But I tried to give up my aviation contract in the basic school. That's how much of the Kool-Aid I was chugging.
You know, I did that. I joined. I mean, I didn't know. I raised in, born in Sacramento, but my dad managed the Padres. So we moved to, you know, we spent summers in San Diego for, I want to say, four different years. And I was between the age of like maybe 15 and 19. So you see Marines and they're impressive. And I remember I used to see them Sundays when the Padres used to play, they'd bring, you know, recruits there. And the recruits would sit there and watch the game, right, in their seats. And you'd have another probably series of recruits from the Naval Training Center. And they would be all over the place. they would be yucking it up, and then you'd look at the Marines, and they're all sitting in their seats, you know, watching the game, and so I just remember seeing them, and when I looked at the military, there was no question. I wanted to be. They'd made such an impression on me. I wanted to be a Marine. I go to see my recruiter, R.C. Erickson, artillery guy in R.S. Los Angeles, and he says, "So you have any idea what you want to do in the Marine Corps?" And I said, "No, you know, I'm kind of an open slate. Like, what do you think?" And he must have had aviation slots because he shows me an F-18. The underside of a banking F-18, and he says, "How'd you like to fly these?" And I said, "Like, would they let me?"
And he said, "To dig you." Yeah.
He says, "Of course." He says, "Of course." He said, "How's your vision?" I said, "I think it's all right." And he said, "All right, well, you got to go down and take the aviation physical." So I did that, and then when I tried to run out of the barracks, I was there the week before, because aviators have to do their physicals the week before everybody shows up at OCS in case you can't pass it. And so I was I did that, and when I got to the basic school before they had the first aviation meeting that Lieutenant Colonel Amos held. No, it wasn't Lieutenant Colonel Amos. I can't remember who it was at the time. When I was second lieutenant, I'm thinking later, but he when they said where they called everybody's name, and I told them, I had asked, I said, "What happens if I don't show up?" And they said, they'll drop you and you'll have a ground contract. And I didn't show up. And I had watched my dad manage a baseball team and kind of be a little platoon commander. And I knew how to do that. And I watched him like manage a lineup card in a game and kind of move, counter move. And in my mind, I knew how to do tactics in my head. And I thought, you know what? I know that I can be a rifle platoon commander. And I like that. And so that's how a very similar story though. I mean, in terms of, you know, you drink the Kool-Aid and then you get around it. And if you're a team guy and, you know, you like being around that, it's a very natural fit. And, so I'm very much the same.
I walked into my, it was, I don't recall how long it was, but it was probably several months into the basic school. And I was learning and developing the Marine Corps taught me, you know, leadership and followership. You know, I'd never been a captain of the football team or the big, you know, leader or whatever. You know, I was kind of just in the pack. So, you know, I started learning this in the Marine Corps, you know, and I had a great SBC. This guy's name was Dick Lewis. He was a black officer. He was a captain. He had like 6 Purple Hearts. He'd been a Navy corpsman his first tour. He was a phenomenal guy. And of course, you know, he was a god. And so I walked into his office and I said, "I want to give up my aviation contract." And he said, "No, I won't let you do that. You can't. I disapprove it." And I'm like, "Yeah, but I want to be a grunt, you know?" And he said, "Listen, and this was in 1975. And he said, I've got, and there was no IOC. Remember the basic school, you know, guys came out of the basic school and they went straight to be platoon commanders. He goes, I got people that can be infantry officers. What we need is people in the aviation community to think like you," he said. And I was like, "Oh, whatever that means." So I was like, "Damn, he won't let me do it." And so I left. Of course, it was years later that I realized that he didn't have the authority to do it. He had to pay. But I was like, "Okay, Lewis said it. He's disapproving it." So he disapproved it, you know. And of course, that wasn't supposed to be. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, I actually tried. And that reinforced all the more the Cobra, you know, because the Cobra guys, they, you know, you'd see the pictures of them landing and talking with the grunts and, you know, you're down in the stuff. Yeah, in it with them and everything. So it became all the more what I wanted to do. And I truly did. So it was fun. And you know, these were 1974, when I came in, it was OCS. We started with like 60 guys, 60-something guys in my platoon, and we graduated 23. You know, and you had to stay, like, what is it? You had to stay 4 weeks. You couldn't DOR immediately.
Right.
You know, you couldn't wuss out immediately. You had to stay 4 weeks. And then at that 4-week thing, it was like rats on a sinking ship, man. Everybody was bailing. And I can remember Staff Sergeant Harrison, you know, moving us all towards the middle of the squad bay, rolling up the fart sacks and on the racks on the outboard corners and coming in saying, okay, now we can get down to business. You know, I mean, we graduated 23 out of 60-something. I mean, it was the quality of guys coming in, it was nowhere near.
But you know, I'll tell you, in 1983, we graduated 22. Craig Timberlake.
Craig Timberlake.
Was my
on Okinawa.
Was my platoon sergeant.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah. McNamara. You know there's no way you're going to get commissioned, don't you?
Yeah.
No platoon sergeant, I don't know that. McNamara, say yes, platoon sergeant. McNamara, you're going to DOR for me.
He was your platoon sergeant?
He was my platoon sergeant.
Oh, God, yeah, mine was Staff Sergeant Harrison.
Craig Q. Timberlake.
Yeah.
And, and the Marine Corps back in the 70s and in the early 80s, I mean, you were taught by Vietnam guys.
Yeah.
And they were harder than woodpecker dips because they got killed by World War II and Korean guys. And then they went to Vietnam, and then they decided to stay in. And they were mean. Yeah. They could be mean, and there was not a whole lot of messing around going on because they were going to prepare you to be attacked by the NVA at night.
Yeah. Staff Sergeant Harrison had a Purple Heart, you know, which is, you know, the red badge of courage. We were like, oh, he could kill us if he wanted to. he's bad, you know, badass. And of course, this was in the winter, so they're wearing their Bravos, you know. So they got the tie, you know, with that tight field knot, you know, and they were.
Whew. All right, I'm gonna ask you a question, then we'll take a break. And I'm gonna limit you to two. And don't give me the general officer song and dance. Oh, Mac, I'm only two people that made huge impact on you relative to being a leader in your career.
I think, you know, one has got to be Jim Amos, you know, got to be Amos, with just the mentoring and a lot of the stuff that I got from him. And then I'd say, and I'm not going to throw him under the bus by putting his name out, but he was the worst squadron commander I ever had. I learned more about leadership being around that guy, you know, by seeing what not to do. But Amos about what to do, and this guy about what not to do. And the guy that, and I'll throw in a third, the guy that started me on the path, right, was Dick Lewis, Captain Lewis.
Interesting how give me General Amos. Give me
Lieutenant Colonel.
Down the hall at CNL. And you know, he was always, General Amos, always smooth as glass too, right? He's a good looking guy. He's a jet guy, right?
Yeah.
Not some kind of candy ass Cobra nonsense. He was
That's a jet guy.
And tell me something that we don't know about him that you do, because you worked with him on more than one occasion.
He was a guy that struggled. You know, he had broken time. A lot of people don't know that. He got out of the Marine Corps and went to work for Braniff Airlines. Tamer's probably going to hunt me down and kill me for telling all this, but you know, he flew for Braniff, and then Braniff folded. And he ended up painting houses. He was a painter. He painted houses for a while. He taught me how to paint. And he's painting, and then he comes back into the Marine Corps. And, you know, and a lot of people don't know this. He got passed over, I think, his first time for I think it was Lieutenant Colonel or Colonel. You know, is that standard slap on the wrist for broken time or whatever.
Right.
You know, and then he goes on. Let me tell you a quick story. We would go to the basic school. I mean, when we were in the basic school, we'd go to those mess nights. And you remember the mess nights when we were there, Mac, you know? And so we would alternate. We both lived in Aquia Harbor, and so we'd take turns driving. And it's my turn to, it's his turn to drive. So we go to one of these mess nights, so I'm having fun because I know I'm not going to drive or whatever. And, you know, towards the end of the evening, he comes up to me, he says, "You're driving home." And I go, no. It's your turn. He goes, "Hey, I got more to lose than you." and he says, it's It's you're driving home. And then he tosses me his keys and walked away, and I think I said to the guy next to me, this is bullshit. You know, he's not going anywhere anyway. Oh, God. We had a good time. And but he did a lot for me, especially in some one of my dark times, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure.
The all right, we're going to take a quick break. My guest this morning is Boomer Milstead, and we go back, obviously, a long ways. We're talking about his career. We got some more ground to cover. We'll talk about talk about combat tours, lessons learned from that kind of stuff. We'll talk current events. So a fun day here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break. More of this program coming up next.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Wednesday, Mike McNamara with you. I'm joined by Robert Boomer Milstead, and retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General, and we're talking about his career and his life in the Marine Corps. So, first of all, thanks for doing this. I certainly appreciate it, and I've been looking forward to it. The talk to me about tours that when you look back, other than combat tours, that were really special in your life and made a difference?
Well, I mean, I certainly enjoyed those early days, you know, being a lieutenant, a captain in the squadron, you know, being a Cobra guy. We spent a lot of time, 29 Palms, of course, being stationed on the West Coast. You know, we had a lot of good ranges out there, Yuma, spent a lot of time down in the Yuma ranges, the 29 Palms ranges, you know, back in the Caxes. Remember, we did the Caxes, and those were good times. Squadron was tight, and we did a lot of flying. Did a UDP in the squadron and a cruise. Funny, the UDP I went on, I was a brand new first lieutenant. I went on the first UDP we ever did in the Marine Corps. The first UDP of all the UDPs. Was an aviation unit. It was a Cobra detachment, not even a full squadron. There was a baker's dozen of us, 13 of us, and we went to Okinawa in 1977. Wow. And we were getting $10 a day per diem.
Nice.
And which made us very unpopular with everybody else that was over there on a 12-month tour. And we got integrated into HML 367, a squadron that was there. We were flying out of Hamby Field down on the, it's no longer there. That's pachinko parlors now, I think. And that was it. And then I came back and got married, and then we went out on a cruise on the old LPH on the Tripoli. Did
wow.
That. Came back and then I went to Anglico. And that was a fun tour. I always wanted to go to Anglico, and thought of jumping out of airplanes terrorized me, so I did it. And but really, I saw a guy in his blues, and he had two sets of gold wings, and I was like, now that is what I'm talking about.
How do I do that?
How do I do that?
I got to do what?
He's like, yeah, Anglico. So it was great. I ended up spending 2 years there. Went through Pathfinder school. That was a great tour. That was one of my fun tours. You know, it's funny. I mean, just probably some of my best and most memorable and most enjoyable tours were out of the cockpit. That's kind of, you know, unusual for an aviator to say.
It is.
You know, certainly squadron command was great. But, you know, it did that. But I think, you know, and then again, staying out of the combat, I think, you know, my time, two one tour really that jumps out that I spent as a one star and then later as a two star was when I had the recruiting command. That was one of my most enjoyable tours.
Why?
You know, because it was all about Marines. You know, I mean, you talk about distributed ops. You know, what, there's 6 Marine Corps districts, 48 recruiting stations, and about 1,500, I want to say, RSSs. You know, that's almost 1,600 fighting positions all across all 50 United States. And, hell, there's even an RSS or a PCS or Florida, I forget what they're, whatever they call them, but it's a recruiting fighting position on American Samoa. And we were involved in the ramp. Remember when we grew the Marine Corps from, we were going to grow the Marine Corps to 202. But I got to get out and travel around and just be around Marines. And I worked for one guy. I mean, I worked for the Commandant. You know, granted, you know, ACMAC, you'd have to dance to his fiddle, but you know, you didn't work for MNRA. You worked directly for the Commandant. And I didn't work for a bunch of generals or anything, and so I was out. And Suzanne got to travel with me, too, which was a real force multiplier with the families out there. What? It was just a great tour.
I haven't heard that too much in terms of, you know, spouse being able to travel with you. Is that because you were on the road so much?
Well, no. I asked General Amos. I said, hey, listen, there's just so many – they bring a perspective to it. Because, again, this is distributed ops, so we've got to, you know, and the majority of those fighting positions are run by a staff NCO or an NCO, a junior staff NCO or an NCO. And Suzanne would just here's a great example. So we're in Texas, we're in Abilene, in Texas, and we're visiting. And when I would go in, and she would travel with me. I'd go in and I'd be talking to the staff NCO, you know, okay, or the sergeant who's in charge of, show me your assets board, you know, here it is. What are the schools that you're dealing with? What are your challenges and everything? And Suzanne would sit out there and talk with the young recruiters, the guys actually, you know, the corporals, the sergeants, the guys that are actually, you know, that are doing, you know, where the rubber meets the road. And so we leave and we get in the car and she goes, you got a problem. And I'm like, what do you mean I got a problem? She said, you got a problem. So she's talking to this guy, and he's telling her that they can't get medical care, that the Air Force will not take care of them. There's an Air Force base in Abilene. And I'm like, so, well, that doesn't make sense. And she said his wife is pregnant, and the Air Force won't take care of him. So I was like, well, this is the first I've heard about it. So, I talked to the RSCO. I said, well, what's going on? He goes, I don't know. Well, to make a long story short, what it was the Air Force, like Quantico, doesn't have a hospital. It has a clinic. And they don't have any OBGYN services or any of that stuff. So what do you have to do? You're supposed to get it in town through TRICARE, like anybody else. But this family doesn't know that. Ooh. In the recruiting command, we were not teaching these kids, you know, about their medical care and what they're going to have to do when they're out and about, you know, distributed across the country. So we started a class and we put our shoulder behind it and made an effort and made sure that, because, you know, most guys, if you ask a guy, you know, what's your health care, they just, their eyes, it beats very quickly. You know, it's the wives that.
Right,
it's all that stuff.
Like, I don't know. I
don't know. She can, just takes them.
I can call my wife though.
Yeah, and so, you know, and I looked at the RSCO. I said, "What's yours?" And when he gave me the rapid eye blink, I was like, "All right, we need to do something." So we did something. But my wife, you know, she helped on that. And I could sit here and tell you more stories. You know, when she would be out. One other one, real quick. She's talking to a guy and. She said, so what's the biggest challenge you face here and everything? And he goes, rejection. And she's talking to a recruiter. And she said, okay, I understand, you know, you want to try and get a guy to join the Marine Corps and he decides not to. And he goes, oh no, ma'am, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a kid that, that life has wanted to be a Marine. You know, his bedroom is wallpapered in Marine posters. You know, as a kid, he slept in camouflage pajamas. And I got to sit at the kitchen table and tell him he's got tears in his eyes. His parents have tears in his eyes. I got to tell him that he doesn't rise to the bar of what we have, either due to physical reasons or aptitude or whatever. He goes, that's the rejection that I find difficult. I was like, she told me, I was like, wow. I mean, it's just, I got stories and stories of what she brought to the table. Interesting.
The let me weave a current events question in here. Is selling the Marine Corps to women, is that a hard sell?
I think it's a special sell. You know, not every woman wants to join the military.
Which is true of males, right? There's a whole lot of guys that you meet in the military that said, you know, I wanted to be a Marine, but all that craziness.
Guys that join the Marine Corps, I mean, they're lined up. I mean, you know, people are still, there's a queue to come to go to boot camp. I mean, they line up. People don't join them. People join the Marine Corps for one reason, because they want to be a Marine. You know, we don't offer you jack shit. We offer you, you know, a set of blues and the opportunity to transform your life and become a United States Marine. That's all we offer you. And when we talk, if you want a little bit later about recruiting, I could tell you some stories of guys, you know, that just walked away from big bonuses with the Army and joined the Marine Corps. And you look at them and say, why'd you do that? And they look at you like you're an idiot and say, because I wanted to be a Marine. But back to your question on the women. So it's a special breed. I remember I asked one gal, I said, what's your attraction? Why do you want to join the Marine Corps? And she says, I want to belong. That was her answer. I want to belong. And then later they told me she came from a dyslexic family. Her mother was an alcoholic. She didn't have a dad. She says, I want to belong to something that's special. And, you know, I'll never forget that. So I think it's a special breed that, you know, people join the Marine Corps because for one reason, they want to be Marines.
It's a special cell to a female like males that is looking for something different. You just got to find.
Yeah, them. I think so. And we have a pretty we do set a bar. We set a pretty high bar, and you know, I think that we're challenged. I don't want to speak for the recruiting command, but when I had it, I mean, it was a challenge to make mission to get women of you know, that rose to the bar to be Marines. I mean, it's just not every gal wants. It's a special person.
All right, let's talk combat tours. First time you deployed for a contingency was
Somalia, I guess, if you want to call it a contingency. Before that was right after Desert Storm. I deployed from Okinawa to northern Iraq, into Turkey, and then into northern Iraq as we were pulling Kurds out of the mountains. But there were still some Iraqis around, but that, you know, I wouldn't consider that. But, it, you know, it was Operation Provide Comfort. I think that was the first time I, you know, ever got anywhere close to the sound of cannons.
All right. Give me a lesson learned from the first time that you know, that they loaded live ammunition and you operated in that environment. A lesson learned from that deployment.
You better know your shit. I mean, you know, the days of CAXs and the days of, you know, okay, you know, let's cease fire. Let's talk about what we were doing or whatever. I mean, this was, and we were out there with some pros. We were in the hills with, we had Royal Marines.
Right.
With us out there. We had special forces were up there. We had some real pros. And, you know, what drove that point home was that you better know your stuff. And leadership's important. You know, the Marines are looking to you. And, it's a no fail situation. So that was a miserable time prior to that. 'Cause I was on Okinawa during the war, if you want to call it the war, you know, during Desert Shield. Remember, we left the basic school. I left the basic school in 90. I think you were still there when I left, right?
I was. No, yeah. We did the same thing. We thought, you know, we're teaching at the infantry officer course, and we think, well, if they need guys, they'll come.
They need us.
And they came down and told everybody, hey, look, none of you guys are going, so stop calling.
Yeah. And quit your bitching.
Yeah,
and you're like, how can you have a war without me?
Yeah.
I mean, that's me. I mean, I'm on Okinawa, Mac. I'm on Okinawa.
In an operating unit.
I went through refresher training, and I was out in Pendleton going through refresher training after being at the basic school, getting snapped back into the Cobra when Hussein rolled into Kuwait. And everybody started, you know, running around with a bayonet in their teeth, and they started deploying. And so I went to the group commander and said, hey, there can't be a war without Boomer Milstead. You know, hey, I'm going to Okinawa. But you know what? I'm not on Okinawa. I'm right here. You can pull me right into the mag.
Exactly.
And I'm ready to go. And
let's do this.
Let's do it, you know. And he actually talked to the mag commander on Okinawa. And he said, no, Milstead's coming. And I was miserable. I sat over there and watched all this. I was like, you got to be shitting me, man. There's a war, and I'm not involved in it. Oh, that was – well, you know how it is. I don't have to tell you.
No,
you were miserable, weren't you?
Yeah. And we were talking to lieutenants that were – I mean, I remember in Kafji, they're firefighting Kafji. And they're guys who you were teaching, you know, 3 months ago. And they called back
– my lieutenants.
They're my lieutenants from
– one of my lieutenants from Alpha Company, won a Silver Star with Mattis going through the minefield.
Wow.
These are the guys we're training, and they're in it. And I'm like, this is such bullshit. I can't believe it. I was miserable.
Again.
It's probably a lot of pride. You know, when you boil it down, you got to admit, but still.
Right.
I mean, we've been training. We wanted it. And so, but anyway, then I got to go into northern Iraq as the XO of a special purpose MAGTF. It was pretty much, you know, logistics heavy because we had a lot of, you know, MHE stuff, and I ended up running the airfield at Sursink, and I was there for about 3.5 months.
All right. Give me a lesson learned from that.
Well, you know, again, that was the first time. It was, you know, hey, you better,
know your stuff.
You know, there are no second acts.
Okay, next contingency deployment is what?
Somalia. So this is crawl, walk, you know,
right,
run.
Right.
So go into Somalia. I come out of Okinawa. I'm sitting up on the wing headquarters. I was gonna go down to the MAG. I was gonna be a squadron XO, and they saw my name coming back from Okinawa, and they snagged me and pulled me up to the wing headquarters. Oh, my God. And so I'm on the wing staff up there, and then Somalia hits, and then they have to put together the Marine Corps, or the 1st Marine Division is going to go to Somalia. And so with it, then there needs to be some sort of an aviation combat element. And so I end up somehow talking my way into it with working for the division air officer. And so I got over to Somalia for a short bit. So that was the second one.
All right. Lesson learned from that.
You better know your stuff again. It was, I was a staff guy. I was more of a staff guy there, you know, again, just know your stuff. You know, I mean, I wasn't in a real strong leadership. You're always in a leadership position, but it was, that was a miserable time in my life for a lot of other reasons that we can talk about at some point. Command screening, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I was kind of running from that stuff to get into Somalia.
All right. So your next one. I got a text message. We're in Somalia. Were you with the gunslingers?
No, the gunfighters were over there, but no, I wasn't with 369. My good friend Dave Fulton was the CO of it. BC Bell was the XO of it. No, I was with the division. I was kind of the ace forward, and then I ended up being forward with the division, and then my daughter got sick and I got pulled out of there and I came home. I spent Christmas over there, but then I came home. But the gunfighters were there. That was HMLA 369. And I'd taken my flight gear and hoped to fly with them a little bit, but I got pulled out of there. I only spent about a month. This memory serves me before my daughter got sick, and I got brought home.
All right. So after that, what's next in terms of contingencies?
After that, you know, it's the next time that I get anywhere towards the sound. I'm the MAG 29 commander in OIF-1.
So talk about it. Give me a lesson learned. Chief lesson learned out of that when you think back on that is what?
Wow. Just many. I mean, it's to walk the dog a little bit. MAG 29 was the aviation combat element for the 2nd MEB. So we worked up and sailed from Camp Lejeune. We were on the Saipan. General Natonsky and the staff was on the Kearsarge. We also had the baton with us, had the Harriers on the baton, and we sailed over there as a MEB. So I deployed as a MEB, but then I became employed as a MAG as soon as we got into the AO.
Right.
We flew the grunts ashore. We flew Natonsky's, you know, and it was Ron Bailey's second Marines. We flew them ashore, and then we chopped to Amos. Amos was the wing commander, 3rd MAW. So we chopped to him, and then we fought as a Marine aircraft group under Amos until it was over, and then we chopped back to Natonsky and the 2nd MED. They were calling themselves Task Force Terrella, and then redeployed home. My lesson then, I guess the biggest one then was, you know, the grave responsibility you had, because this was no shit combat, and I mean, bullets were flying, and you know, I had 3 or 4 squadrons, and so the biggest thing I learned there is calm like panic is contagious. You know, everybody was looking to you. And I can remember bringing Phil in the wardroom with all our officers a couple nights and said, you know, listen, does anybody in here doubt that we're going to go to war? And so, just think about this. And just because we're going to war, you know, a couple of them laughed and then you said, doesn't mean you have to do it with a stick up your ass. So, you know, maintain your demeanor, because remember, your Marines are looking to you. So they said, I said something like, you know, calm like panic is contagious, be contagious. And, that was a special time. I mean, I'll look back on that in my time as a wing commander, when I'm an old man sitting on the front porch sucking on a fish stick.
And the calm like panic, you know, it's interesting. I think I had a Marine in Afghanistan, our ace guys who worked for us every day, who awesome young Marines, led by a first lieutenant. But, you know, they were the coordinating element in the 1st Marine Regimental Combat Operations Center. And we fought every day in Afghanistan. And they were involved in every critical thing we did, medevacs and aviation ordnance. It was them. And I remember their lieutenant came up to me when they got ready to leave, and they left before we did. And he said, hey, sir, I want to thank you for, you know, everything you've done for us, blah, blah, blah. I said, get out of here, man. You guys were awesome. And he said, the other thing I want to thank you, he said, you made this fun. He said, I would never have thought that I would look back and think about how much we laughed and how fun this was. And I said, sit down. And he looked at me and he said, uh-oh. And I said, no. I said, do you think that's by fiat? Do you think that just happened? And I said, no, look, most of the guys you see in here are multiple combat tour guys, right? There's enough stress to go around in this job every day where, you know, you're in the business of helping kill people and help save people. If you don't let it breathe, if you don't bring laughter here, it makes it very, very difficult. So not by design. I said, the reason we're having this conversation is I said, you have that kind of a personality where you can do this. You can add that to, and that way your guys will be more effective because they'll be able to let some steam off and relax and then be focused. I said, and there's a lot to that. And I said, I was taught that myself. And I said, so I offer that to you. But it is, I mean, calm, you know, and as we all know, the enemy has a vote and all those different things you hear. Well, they're true. They're true. And you're going to have days when you get your nose bloodied and how you come back and how you deal with that. What's the other one I've heard? Slow as pro.
Yeah.
Slow as pro. The, all right, give me a,
well, you know, and go ahead. Do you do that? I mean, if you were to go out and talk to guys that had served with me under the, you know, in combat, either, you know, when I was the mag commander or the wing commander, I would hope that that's one of the things that they would say, you know, I mean, that I tried to keep a sense of humor. I tried to make people, you know, I mean, that kind of like that just because we're in combat doesn't mean you have to have a stick up your ass. In other words, it's still serious business, but, you know, you got to be able to laugh. You got to be able to laugh at others. You got to be able to laugh at yourself. And some of the most humorous things that I can recall have been in some of the more, you know, demanding times. I mean, it's a great release of tension is to laugh. You know, I mean, just stop and think about some of the stuff. Sometimes you're like, you know, holy shit, I can't believe that happened. You know, people should have probably ended up hurt, but they weren't. And you just got to laugh about it, you know, and just say, holy mackerel. Yeah.
My guest today is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Boomer Milstead. And got an email for you, sir. Hey, Mac, question. Lieutenant General, did he ever in his life think that he would rise to that kind of rank? That is a small circle in terms of the United States military. He sounds like a very easygoing and fun guy, which most generals have a little bit different persona. Is there a trick to that? So did you ever think that
no.
You would
rise? Shit, no. I never thought I'd be, you know, I wanted to be a squadron commander.
Right.
You know, I didn't come in to do 20. I didn't come in to do 30 or 40. You know, I mean, you end up eating the elephant. When it's all said and done, you're like, holy shit, I've eaten the elephant. But you do it at a bite at a time. I mean, okay, I ended up doing 20, you know, and then we're hanging around. Then you go to school or, you know, they keep doing things where they keep their claws in you. And then I did 30, and I was going to retire, and then they made me a general, and then I hung around another 10 years. But no, I just wanted to be a squadron commander. If I could be a squadron commander, I would have achieved. No, I never thought I was going to be a general. And you and I both have known some guys that walk around thinking they're going to be generals back in the day. Remember?
Right. No.
But no.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
No. And then once I was, I always felt like I was one step ahead of being discovered. You know, like, hey.
Are you Milstead?
How the hell do we?
What are you doing here? You're not supposed to be.
Yeah. I can remember walking down the stairs one morning. I was in my Charlies. This is right after I'd been promoted to 3 stars. I'm in my Charlies, you know, you got your ribbons and shit, and you come down the stairs. And my wife's sitting at the kitchen table drinking a cup of coffee, and she looks up at me and she starts laughing. I was like, hey, stop that. That's not helpful. You're not being helpful for my confidence. Oh, God.
That is funny. Talk to me about the most difficult tour when you look back. The tour that presented the most challenge for you, the most challenges for you as a leader.
Probably as a squadron commander, it's challenging as a leader. But the most challenging command first was because to talk about me, I have to talk about the period when I came back from Okinawa, like I was talking about, and right before we went to Somalia, that was the first command screening. I was a selected lieutenant colonel, but I was still a major. And the Marine Corps decided, okay, we're gonna do the command screening program. And that's when they started it in 90 or 91. 91. I think the first results were 92. So anyway, so I'm still a major, but yet because you're a lieutenant colonel select, what do you do? Your name gets thrown in to the, you're part of those considered. Well, I wasn't selected. You know, I came out on the command screening board, the first one ever. I wasn't even an alternate. You know, Major Milstead, there's all these lieutenant colonels or whatever. But however I wanted to justify it, I wasn't on it. And I was crushed, absolutely crushed. I mean, I wanted to graduate from college. I graduated from college. I wanted to join the Marine Corps. I was commissioned a Marine. I wanted to get wings. I graduated from flight school. The woman I loved, I wanted to marry me. She married me. I had never dealt with defeat like this. I mean, I was absolutely crushed. And, you know, people would say, well, what do you expect? You're a major select. There's all these lieutenant colonels. You know, they got to take care of them first. But to me, it was failure. And it was a dark time. And that singly would probably be, I learned a lot about myself. And that's one time when General Amos, I wrote to him or called him, and he was, he told me something. He said, listen, you know, you're going to look back on this at some point, and it's going to water your eyes. You just got to trust God, trust yourself, trust your family. And, you know, he was very helpful on that. But that was the most difficult time of my career. Personally, probably the biggest leadership challenges were as a squadron commander. You know, you got what, 300 Marines. You're still learning. You're still there?
I am.
Okay, you're still learning. I think I squeezed the phone extra hard coming off. But you're still learning. You're making some mistakes. You know, I'd say probably the mistakes that I made more as a squadron commander were not things I did, probably were things I failed to do. You know, the old Catholic, you know, the sins of omission, vice commission. But that was a great time. You know, I commanded the squadron that I was raised in, HMLA 169, the old HMA 169 Vipers. That was a special time. Great time.
My guest is retired Lieutenant General Robert Milstead, call sign Boomer. You know, it's interesting because the challenges in our careers, you know, probably define us more than our successes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget not being able to get up the rope at the obstacle course at OCS. I didn't know how to climb the rope. I didn't know that it's more about your legs than it is about your arms. And I got within like 3 feet of the top, and I remember not being able to get to it. And so I failed in front of everybody, and Timberlake had my ass, you know, in a very public way. And it, for me, it was one of those defining failures. And I remember seeing a watercolor that they sold when I went back to the basic school as an instructor. They sold a watercolor of OCS, and it had the old administrative building with a sign out in front that said Officer Candidate School. And in the background, they had the ropes with the scaffolding that they hung on, they hang on. And I bought the watercolor to remind myself of what it was to fail. In a very public way in the Marine Corps. But those kind of failures, and it doesn't matter, you know, and people say a lot of different things to guys. I mean, it's like when your kids get cut from teams. What can you say to them? You know, hey, you know, your coach is an idiot or what? That doesn't make it, that doesn't soothe the pain. That does not.
No, especially for, you know, I don't think you'll meet anybody that's been any kind of success in their life that cannot identify some times of failure or some times of personal, you know, walking through the dark forest. You know what? And I think, you know, all the bullshit aside about, oh, you know, the fire makes you stronger and all that other stuff. No, you know, it's just everybody's dealt with it. And it's how you deal with it. It's like how you deal with fear. You know, I mean, without fear, there can be no courage. And I think that without these things happening to us, at some point you just kind of run out of steam. I think that's what keeps you going. because you can always look back on them. I mean, even now I can look back on those dark times and go, you know, thank you, God, for getting me through it. Thank you, my wife and family, for getting me through it. You know, it just, I mean, I was fighting depression, fighting, you know, it was just failure. And it can be profound, but it, in the long run, I think that's what General Amos was trying to tell me. It can make you better.
That stuff is hard because my sister, her two sons were murdered by their father. And, exactly. The worst thing I've ever seen in my life.
My mind won't go there.
Of all the things I've ever seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, nothing dwarfs what my sister went through. Because none of us ever had to deal with seeing our family get, you know, shot and killed. And in the aftermath, people come up and they say those things. There's a purpose in this. The hardest steel goes to the hottest fire. God needed more. You know, all these things. And you just look and you're like, please don't say that stuff to me. Okay.
That's right.
It just don't say that to me. I'm struggling.
It's not helpful.
I'm struggling with it. You know, come up and give me a hug. Put your hand on my shoulder, but don't say something trite that you think is soothing to somebody. I don't want to say that's inconsolable, that needs your support, but don't. I know, and a lot of people offer that stuff out of nervousness.
Mm-hmm.
Out of nervousness, and yet, but it's hard to hear. Let's talk post-combat related mental health. What do you say to guys who struggle?
I tell them how I struggle. You know, I think, you know, when you talk about post-combat mental health, I think, you know, first thing is to couple stakes need to be driven around. First of all, you know, I mean, I think the first guy that really started it was Joe Dunford, you know, dropping the D, you know, that, you know, it's post-traumatic stress. You know, it's not a disorder. It's a normal reaction to some not normal circumstances that you've been under. So I think that's one. Two is that we all get it. Nobody comes home from war the same guy that went. But guys like you and I are a little bit older. We have life skills. We can compartmentalize. You know, it depends on what you see. But, you know, for a 20-year-old kid, you know, or a 22-year-old kid that's been through something, or a young man, you know, that's been through something, he's going to deal with it, you know, he can't compartmentalize it necessarily as well. So I think the Marine Corps has made some great strides in, you know, the resiliency. Recognizing what resiliency is, you know, it's psychological, it's physical, it's social, and it's spiritual. There is definitely a spiritual piece to resiliency. I think people that have a faith in whatever your faith is, if you have a faith, you can be a little bit more resilient. But,
you know, the other part is I think it's really interesting. You know, well, this is again, how far Boomer and I go back. Because he was there when this happened, 1993. There's a Huey crash that people who've listened to the program have heard me discuss before. You know, it was the first time I really dealt with intimate death, trying to save somebody, and you're trying as hard as you can. They're trying as hard as they can to live, and you know you're connected to them physically, and it doesn't work, and it's crushing. You know, and I only knew Sergeant Bazzarini for 20 minutes, but there's not a week in my life that goes by that I don't think about him. And so, unbeknownst to me, heading the investigation team was Boomer Milstead. And so my company's providing security for the site, and I have my CP someplace, and I know that these guys have showed up late in the afternoon. It happened early in the morning. They show up late in the afternoon, and they're down in Wood Canyon. And, you know, they're just living out there administratively. And one of my Marines comes to me and says, hey, one of my staff NCOs, hey, so they've got a fire going, and and I don't know what's going on down there.
I know where this is going.
And so I walk down there and they're yucking it up. And I walk in, and there's this fire going in the middle, and they have cots out, and they're sitting there, and they're just yucking it up. And I said, who the fuck's in charge down here? And out of the dark, I hear, I am, Mac. You got a problem with it? And I'm like, Boomer, what's going on? He's like, oh, what are you going to do, be an uptight grunt and shut us all down and shit? And but you know what? It was such a good thing to see, you know, in the midst of that kind of a situation. And again, the pilots decapitated, co-pilots crushed to death. Two other Marines were in the back, one just on a ride-along. They fought for their lives and lost that fight. And so, I mean, it was a rough day. You know, now you have to go find body parts and doing it. I'd never done that before. And my gunny comes up to me late in the day and he says, hey, sir, how are you? And I said, I don't know. Probably one of the good things about being in charge is I haven't thought about that. And he said, you know, you'll never get over this. And I said, what? And he said, you'll never get over this. And this is exactly what I said. I'm not exactly fucking sure, but I'm pretty fucking sure that the fucking therapist doesn't say that to the fucking patient right about fucking now. So why don't you get the fuck away from me? And he said, no, you need to know that. I said, who told you that? And why do I need to know it? He said, guys from Vietnam told me. And just know that you're a human being. And he said, I heard what happened today. And he said, I heard what everybody did. And he said, I went through something not nearly like this. And it's good advice. And he said, you won't get over it. Trust me. And he said, when it reaches out and grabs you, just know that you're a human being and it's okay. Boomer, I've never got better advice in my life than that.
Yeah.
And I shared that with, I'd hear about Marines that are struggling and that were struggling. And I'd say, hey, come here, sit down. Hey, I hear you're having nightmares. I hear you can't sleep. And, you know, I'm a major. He's a Lance Corporal. And they look at you like, sir, how did you know about that? I'm like, because I pay attention. I said, you think you're fucked up, don't you? And they look at you, right, with Operation Big Eyes, like, I don't know. And I would say, well, you are fucked up. And then they would laugh, right? And then say, but just like a lot of guys in here.
That's right.
I said, do you ever watch the History Channel?
And right. You humanize it. I mean, you make right. It realize that they're not.
It's not you alone. It's all of us. And I said, do you ever watch History Channel? Oh, sir, I love that stuff. And I say, those fucking pussies from World War II, they're still crying about that shit 65, 70 years later. I said, what you went through seeing that little kid die, I mean, that was 13 days ago. You're not.
Yeah.
You know what, Boomer, the lesson to me was, that was the oral tradition of the Marine Corps, how we took care of post-traumatic stress, handed down to me by Gunny. Where did he get it? Vietnam guys. Where the hell did they get it? Korean War, right? World War II guys? Just telling them, hey, man, you're not going to get away from this.
And we learned that. We learned that the hard way, too. One of the things was, you know, you need to be able to talk to guys. Or you need to have, you know, we can be our macho shit all the time. But you know what?
Right.
It's nice to have guys like you and I, or guys that we can talk to, guys that we can open our soul to.
Right.
And we learned that, you know, as we were working up this thing when I was in MNRA, and we're still deploying guys to Iraq, and we're doing it to Afghanistan as well. And I mean, you know, we're meeting ourselves coming and going, and the dwell is not existent. And we had all this focus on cohesion. You know, we were supposed to fix cohesion, and our focus was on the front, you know, getting guys into unit, getting guys into, you know, 2-8, you know, getting them in there so they can work up and everything. And then we'd bring them back, and then what we would do is we'd bust apart the unit and feed guys back out to units that are getting ready to go again. And what we learned was that the focus, the more important aspect of cohesion wasn't on the front end, but it's what we began to call, I called the dark side. It was the back side. It's when the kid does come back that saw the little kid killed, you know, and the last thing you can do is take him away from his friends or the guys that experienced it with him and put him out into some other group of people that he doesn't know. So that's when Amos said, no, we ran it to where you had to remain in a squadron. I mean, or in a squadron, but any combat unit, I think it was 60 to 90 days, and then there had to be a handoff. You know, we talked about, you know, when you hand off gear, You know, you don't transfer weapons from one unit to another without an LTO or whatever, and basically an organized handoff. We need to do that with our Marines. And we got a lot better about it, you know, but you nail it. It's important.
In terms of manpower, that you dealt with, you and I both have a friend, a mutual friend, and that is Jeremiah Workman, who's been on the story, who's been on this program, shared his stories, and Boomer was a part of that story. Jeremiah talked about going, you know, when he went back to be part of Wounded Warrior, he's a celebrity for the thing that he doesn't want to talk about, the thing that he thinks he failed at. And that is a firefight in Fallujah as a corporal, where they killed 24 guys. And I don't care on any day that you've ever been in Iraq or Afghanistan, that's a huge number in a fight. But they lost three guys, and he blames himself for not getting there quick enough. And so he goes to, he gets sent to the Wounded Warrior in Quantico to go there. And then they send him up to the museum, for him to work there, and he absolutely hates it because he winds up talking about that day, and he doesn't want to be a celebrity for that day. In fact, Boomer, you listened to that interview when he says, "I don't want this, I don't need this, I don't deserve this. All I want is those three guys back."
Yeah,
I mean that is what every corporal, sergeant, Lance Corporal who's ever led at that level deals with. Those decisions where you say, no, don't go that way, go that way. And then something bad happens because the enemy has a boat and you deal with it. And it's not easy stuff. And Jeremiah is a great piece of that. But, I mean, just the humanity that we're talking about, you kind of interceded in that. I mean, tell that little story, would you?
Well, I'm not so sure, but I remember taking my kids to the museum. We went to the museum one day, and I think it was a Saturday. We went to the museum, and we're moving around, and then right before you walk into the Purple Fox 46 thing, right there, they've got a stuffed dog, you know, and they got this Marine standing there, and he's in blues, and he's kind of, and I'm like, so hey, what are you doing? And he kind of smiles and says, I'm guarding the dog. You know, I said, what do you mean you're guarding the dog? Fucking dog's dead. And he's like, well, you know, because people like pet it and rub it and shit, so I got to kind of guard it and everything. And I look at this guy and I go, holy shit, that's a fucking Navy cross. That guy's got that ribbon there. That's the blue ribbon with the white stripe. I mean, you don't confuse that with a good conduct medal or a, you know,
I've seen that.
Medal.
I've seen that in I've seen that in pictures.
Yeah, I've seen that medal. I've seen that ribbon in pictures, you know, And I look at it and I just said, you know, say, hey, you know, hey, Boomer Milstead, glad, it's an honor to meet you, you know, and I'm thinking, whoever you are.
Right.
And I said, you don't mind if I said, Jimmy, you know, Melissa, come here, look at that. That's the Navy Cross. That's the second highest award. And in the Marine Corps, we give that because we're too fucking cheap to give the Medal of Honor. Yeah.
Right.
A lot of time.
That's true.
So General Amos was a three-star still, and he had the Quantico, and I just, at some point, I told him, I said, sir, I don't know if you know, but we got a Navy Cross guy because I talked to Jeremiah a little bit, and I said, he's guarding the dog in the museum. And, of course, I didn't have any idea about his PTS and you know, his struggles and everything, and so I kind of got barked at a little bit, but no pun intended. But, you know, Jeremiah ended up, you know, working for Sweet 16, you know, and he was working for Sergeant Major Kent. And, I mean, how lucky can you be if you're a guy that's having some issues to work for, you know, Sergeant Major Kent, the exemplar of senior staff NCO leadership, you know, just a great Marine. So...
No, but it's a great story about the human side of leadership. There's all the rules and all that, but to me, where the rubber meets the road is the people that interpret it and then bring it to other people on a daily basis. And, oh, by the way, make it make sense.
He's a great guy, though. You know, I mean, Workman is quite the character, and hopefully
funny.
He is, you know, he's rebounded. I mean, because his resiliency has got him, got the tree back standing straight and tall, I think.
Well, he's where you should look him up. He doesn't live far from you.
He's down there in Fredericksburg. His wife has a
beauty parlor.
Yeah.
Go get your hair cut. Go get your grass mowed down there.
Go get a head snap.
Exactly.
Go get a head snap.
That's
a fine haircut.
You can go get it styled now. Talk to much in the news is this discussion about Marines United. So I want to talk about that for a few minutes. First of all, your general thoughts about it. This is not a Marine Corps problem. This is a problem that our society deals with starting in elementary school, where kids have phones and take pictures and send text messages and things like that. Yet the Marine Corps finds itself, you know, dead center in this issue of harassment by picture, in this case, using social media. Your general thoughts about it?
Well, I mean, you said it. It's something that goes on in society, and we get our Marines from society. And then we, of course, we break them down to bare metal and then build them back up and through our transformation progress, you know. Sometimes we fail. I mean, this is, look, as I see it, what's particularly disturbing about this is that it has nothing to do with the expanding roles of, you know, women in the Marines. This isn't somebody pissed that we have expanding roles of women in the Marines. These are actions of some number of dirtbags, predators. They're predators toward women in our Corps, regardless of what billet or MOS those women are in. And we just need to simply find them, convict them, and punish them. I mean, this is not what we do. I mean, you know, whether you agree or disagree that we have women in the Marine Corps or to the extent and the roles that they are in, that's, you know, you ride for the man, you wear the brand. And that's who we are. You know, he's your brother, she's your sister. You treat each other accordingly. And we don't tolerate those that don't. That's it. Find these dirtbags, punish them, put them in prison, let them be some really mean man's boyfriend for a number of years.
Every time you get fired up, you do something with your phone.
The phone.
Exactly. you need to relax. Do we need more classes?
No, we don't need any more lectures. We don't need any more videos. We need engaged leadership. We just need to identify these guys. And, we will continue for as long as we have a core and we have this country and we bring people in from this country, we will continue to have episodes like this. And I'm not downplaying it by any means, but in no way do I buy that the 30,000 people were active members of this website. You know, there may have been hits and clicks, whether it whatever, but this is any number of people. We need to find them, identify them, and we need to crush them, you know, and that's it. We don't need, I don't think. And then there may be those that disagree with me. But look, I don't think we need any more classes. We know who we are. We know what the Marine Corps stands for. And we don't stand for this. We don't tolerate this, and we don't tolerate people that partake in this. I mean, this goes on in society. I mean, we did not invent the word revenge porn, did we?
No. 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 And we did not suggest to 35 states and the District of Columbia that there ought to be state laws that prohibit this behavior.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and if the UCMJ does not have some sort of means to handle this, then we need to make it part of it.
Yeah, I think there is a gap, because I think Article 120, Charlie, talks about if you get them, if you peeping Tom images or things like that. And that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about on most, I think on most occasions is you are in a relationship, your girl, probably by your request, sends you, or maybe you're deployed, or for whatever reason, sends you an intimate photograph. You break up, and now you decide that you're going to, you know, you're gonna show these to your friends. And this is to me the part that's despicable. And it's not just, hey, check it out. It is, here's her email address. Here's where she works. Here's her name. Here's her cell phone number. You've essentially weaponized that for her exploitation. Who does that?
A dirtbag, you know, and I don't buy that. Oh, she hurt me, and this is or no, please. No. This is just a
nothing.
Dirtbag.
Nothing justifies exposing her to predators.
No,
nothing.
No, not at all.
And so again, that's why I agree with you. We need to lecture that. If we need to lecture that, then we just need to shut it down.
Yeah.
We don't need to lecture this. No.
This is, and there'll be other instances of things, I don't know what they are, that'll come out, that every once in a while we do certain things, but it's, I mean, I'm hearing that other services are having some of this, you know, and you go, you think?
Yeah.
I mean, we bring these people from society. I would think, hopefully, that we would have less of issues like this with the moral DNA that we have in our core today and the fact that the standard that we hold people to. And I think that's why they get pissed at the Marines, because, you know what, they don't want to admit it, but everybody expects more from the Marines. Everybody expects more of the Marines, you know? Well, I wouldn't have expected this in the Corps. That kind of makes you cower a little bit. You know, they expect more of us. They hold us to a higher standard.
I don't disagree with that. What do you say to, I heard this out of the Commandant yesterday. No, actually, Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps yesterday, who talked about his daughter is 14. What do you say to women as a former head of recruiting when they see this kind of stuff? What do you say to them? What would you say to them today if they were?
I'd say that you know that this is not who we are, and that we won't tolerate and to trust us. You know, I mean, I've got three daughters. We've got three daughters. I've got four granddaughters. I mean, you know, I'm not a woman hater. Quite on the contrary. I just tell them to trust us. You know that there's more of us that are moving in the right direction than aren't, and that we'll find those that aren't, and we're gonna cut it out. It's a cancer, you know. You cut it out. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, this is you see some people are trying to tie this to the expanding roles. It's got nothing to do with that. This is women, regardless of what MOS they're in or wherever. This is just unacceptable, and we just need to crush these people. Simply put, hang them.
I want to play a little piece of audio for you, and this is from a Marine corporal that I had on yesterday after the Commandant's testimony. Her name's Katie White. She's a cook, and I asked her, hold on, you'll hear it. Question one, are you surprised at this?
About this whole situation? Absolutely not. I think it's very comical, actually, due to the circumstances. I mean, this is something, even when I was in a couple of pages, you know, that are exploiting female Marines in a disrespectful manner.
So you know, this is not something new for junior female Marines or female Marines, period. They come into an organization that's 94% male and male in terms of, you know, they come into the Marine Corps because they want to be badasses. They want to be Marines. And and we bring them into this organization, what, 60% of our Marines are under the age of 26 is the number I saw. And that, and we turn over 100,000 Marines about every 4 years. And so we're a young force, and so we deal with these issues of social media. And so how does the command change that? Because what junior Marines, and she goes on to say, and the clip's about 6 minutes long, but she goes on to say, Katie goes on to say, you know, you have a decision to make. If you go public with this, you're just going to make it worse for yourself, because you will be crucified in social media, and you'll be ostracized in your unit because you turned your back on somebody. You know, it wasn't simply his fault. It was partly your fault for putting yourself in that situation. Is there a way out of that quagmire for female Marines?
You know, I think, you know, the majority of this is on the dudes. You know, I think the commandant has said it before. You know, what's it take to accept these women, you know, as Marines, as fellow Marines? I mean, you know, you again, I go back to what I said before. You know, he's your brother, she's your sister. Treat each other accordingly. You know, and if you don't, then you don't belong in the Corps. And we just need to start holding people accountable. Hold people accountable. That's easy to say. Right. It's easy, you know. And again, I'm looking at this as a 65-year-old guy whose own views have transformed over those 40 years in the Corps. But you go back to what you said. The average age of the Marine Corps is 24. You know, we got 56% of the Marine Corps, over 50% of the Marine Corps is on its first enlistment. We're a young force.
That's amazing.
You know, and so a lot of it, we reflect society. And this is something that's going on in society, this whole stuff. You can't just completely bring somebody into the Marine Corps and overnight, you know, change them completely. We work very hard at transformation, and we're very proud of the transformation that we do. But I think we're always going to have some of these issues. And when you have them, again, somebody tells you you got cancer, what do? You cut it out. You know? And that's what we need to do. We need to hold these people accountable.
Should there be a specific article in the UCMJ that says that the transmission of any kind of intimate image that was sent to you with the expectation of privacy is illegal and can be punished under this?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, so but what I would say is whether there needs to be a specific thing in the UCMJ, we need to have sufficient regulations that will allow us to severely punish these people. And if that means adding another specification to the UCMJ, then I'm all for it.
Well, here's why I think this is just Mac. Young people come to us from a culture where that happens on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And now, what percentage of the people that do that are punished under the quote-unquote revenge porn laws of the state?
Very few.
Because I think a woman quite rightly looks at it and says, do I want to put myself through that? And it's the same thing that you heard forever relative to rape cases. Do I want to put myself through that public event, or is it better just for me to make it go away? And so to me, most of the time in the Marine Corps now, we have to raise the bar ethically for young people. They haven't.
We do.
They've never lived by these kind of rules. And so to me, relative to this, what is so prevalent and acceptable in middle school and high school, and they've been a part of it, there needs to be in very bold red letters, if you engage in this behavior, right, you will be punished and you will be put out of the Marine Corps. And because it is, to me, it's horrible. And I having two daughters, for somebody to weaponize something relative to them so that they can be exploited by other guys, I mean, as a father, and your instinct is, I'm going to find who did that, and I'm going to go kill them. I'm going to go beat the shit out of them, and I'm going to do to them, I want them to feel what my daughter feels, you know, and which it's wrong. It's wrong for me to say, but you weaponize that stuff, which is, to me, disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. So
no, I agree with you. You know, and maybe what we need to do, and again, I'm not for more classes and all this other stuff, but maybe we just need to make sure at some point, you know, as in some part of the classes that we already have when these youngsters come through boot camp, is to make sure that they understand that, you know, hey, this is they're now in a different world, and they're held, you know, to a higher standard, and they're held accountable different for more things now than they were before.
But again,
this is, that's just to scratch it. It's the person that does this, that has it inside their heart, inside their body, that decides to do something like that. That's what disturbs me. That's somebody that's been around the Corps for a while. I mean, I'd like to know the demographics when they finally do catch these dirtbags. I'd like to know what the demographics are
in terms of longevity, first
term.
Yeah,
exactly.
Blah, blah, blah. Because I think we'd all like to believe. We'd all like to believe that, these are people that aren't familiar with our culture and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I think the truth is going to be, there's going to be a spread, and there may be.
You're probably right, which will be disturbing, but I would like to believe that they're all, you know, first term, you know, young, first term,
young and dumb.
That's what I'd like to believe. But as you say, you're going to get some that are not.
So this won't be, I mean, they are going to find worse, trust me, than this website. If you start when you start flipping over cans on the internet and you start looking at people's behavior on social media, that's going to be rough going for all the services, because if you do that in society to see what people do anonymously on the internet. Now, I guess, but to me the thing is, and let me read you an email. Hey, Mac, I think the key is, and you've said it repeatedly, hold people responsible until they know that this behavior is going to be punished harshly. Then to me, you know, hey, I'm on the internet. I'm just messing around. I'm just, you know, who's going to hold me accountable? I saw that in the hearing yesterday that there was a story about somebody posted their DD-214 and said, come and get me. He said, that's amazing in terms of the balls people have relative to this issue and thumbing their nose at authority. So I just would say, until people's heads roll, this is just rhetoric. And until female Marines see those heads roll, they'll be reluctant. When we do see heads roll on a regular basis, I think what you'll find is female Marines will be more inclined to bring this to people's attention. Until then, the safest and smartest thing to do is not say a word. Because as Katie White said yesterday, the only thing I would have gotten had I contested or confronted them on the internet was a million times more abuse. And she's absolutely right.
She's right. You know, again, go back. She's your brother. He's your brother. She's your sister. I mean, you know, so if you find out, if you're in a unit and you have a sister Marine and, you know, you get wind of that something like this is going on, you need to get involved, you know?
Okay.
Take care of one another.
One more email, and we'll switch gears. Mac, I think what's disturbing, and the other thing that needs to change, is in addition to the idiots who did this being punished, which I think will certainly happen when NCIS ultimately does what they do, because the good part about the internet is that everything has a digital signature, and if you left your print, that'll be traced to you. So they will trace these people down, they will find them, and they will be punished. My concern is, and I think the harder work is, the bystanders who looked at it and then turned their back and walked away and said, I don't want to be a part of that. The part of the culture that we need to change is not turning your back and walking away, but either reporting it or getting involved in it and say, knock this stuff off. That's what we need as female Marines. we need male Marines to intervene in this stuff and not simply walk away.
And that's what I just said. You know, right. I mean, we need to become involved. I mean, you know, you just need to become involved. It's family, you know, and not in our house. And until we do that, but again, I go back, you know, I'm a 65-year-old guy that's looked back on his career, you know, you'd probably get some different opinions or some different comments, you know, to 27-year-old, you know, First Lieutenant dumbass Milstead.
All right, give me a couple of final things. When you look back on your career in the Marine Corps, give me a couple things that you think of that immediately come to mind.
Leadership. I mean, you know, this is where I learned that it's not about me as much as it's about us. You know, that I just look at the transformation, you know, through 40 years, you know, that's what makes Marines, you know, it's our servant leadership. It's walking the talk. It's, what I learned about myself, but what I learned about people, you know, it's people come up to me, Mac, and they go, you know, holy shit, you did 40 years. Do you miss the Marine Corps? And my answer is no, I don't miss the Marine Corps. I miss Marines. You know, it's Marines I miss. And I look back across my career and I think of just all those guys that I was able to spend time with. And as my wife says, you know, all too often you don't realize you're a role model until it's too late. So I'd like to think that I influenced a lot of people that I'm not even aware of. So it was a great run, and I wouldn't change, you know, I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, I'd have spent more time in the fleet if I could, but then other things would have probably happened. So, I mean, I walked the path that was laid out for me, but, it was a great run, but I miss Marines. That's what I miss is the people, especially the youngsters, you know, Lance Corporals. They were my favorite rank. They could be in trouble and out of trouble and already thought an excuse before you even knew they were in trouble. You know, I loved them.
Let me read one more email. Hey, Mac, it's interesting. I've learned a lot about the metrics of the Marine Corps that I really didn't know. I had no idea that such a large percentage of the Marine Corps was so young. For whatever reason, I thought the demographic was spread out more. It seems to me that when you deal with that population, and then in parentheses, this is not to make an excuse, but you're forming young people. They've lived a certain way in their life. They bring that into the Marine Corps. So I do believe that you're absolutely right. And what General Milstead said is absolutely right. And the time for discussion is over. It needs to be put in front of them. And then when somebody crosses that line, they need to be crushed. This will not be the last time the Marine Corps deals with social media behavior and it not being a very good thing and not being a great example. But the truth is, when all of the services begin to take a look, they will find this kind of behavior in every single one of them. The Marine Corps needs to take its face shot, and I believe this is a great opportunity for General Neller to show what the Marine Corps is all about and its greatness. But it's a hard issue because it's one that our society struggles with, and that is how we treat each other sexually. And I think the Marine Corps will continue to struggle with this and continue to struggle with this just as our society does. It's not an easy subject, but I think what needs to happen, as your previous emailer said, is that men need to get more involved in intervening in these issues. And if that happens, then hopefully that will create an optimum situation relative to reporting it and punishing it. Gone are the days that men can be bystanders. We desperately need them and need their help to put an end to this. I appreciate your program and your willingness to talk about these things. You don't hear too many forums where this is even brought up. Semper Fidelis, thank you.
See, now that email, what'd she say? We desperately need your help. I mean, that needs to be put in neon lights. I mean, our sister Marines are asking us for our help, their help. They desperately need your help, you know, and we're Marine Corps. We don't leave our wounded on the battlefield and we don't turn our back on one another. So that should be the rally cry. You know, they desperately need our help. Let's help them. I mean, to do anything less is to turn your back on what we stand for as a core and what we have stood for all these many years. I mean, we walk to the beat of a different drum. So, you know, get at it, right?
No. No, again, I think that's right. You know, I think that's well said. We need you. And truth be told, I mean, and again, we've dealt with the whole sexual assault thing, too. And
yeah.
But let me tell you, every university deals with it.
Yeah,
you know?
They do.
But our problem is worse because we have a huge population that's young, that's extremely enthusiastic and aggressive, which is why they join the Marine Corps. And I think if it's a certain way in the normal population, it is probably greater in the Marine Corps simply because of the DNA that comes in the Marine Corps.
It's more intense. Right. In other words, it's more, you know, the content is stronger. It's just more intense in the Marine Corps. I mean, the kind of people that we attract. So.
All right. Give me the smartest thing that you ever heard in the Marine Corps. Yeah. Give me words of wisdom.
Congratulations, General Milstead, on your promotion. No. Oh, God. The smartest thing I ever heard?
Yeah. See, I would I would tell you the advice that I got from Gunnery Sergeant Lance Y that September day in 1993. About 4 hours before I came down looking to chew somebody's ass in Wood Canyon for that bonfire. I would tell you that's the best advice or the best thing I ever heard, in the Marine Corps is that, hey, you're not going to get over it, which has helped me and helped a lot of different Marines.
Yeah.
Give me good advice that you got in the Marine Corps.
I remember as a unit, I remember one of the things that Amos told us before we attacked North in March of 2003. He says, you've trained the way you'll fight. Now go fight the way you trained. And that made a lot of sense. You know, guys want to cut corners, you know, in combat. There's no reason to cut corners. You train to fight one way, so go fight that way. That was some pretty sage advice for a unit. I mean, I write down things that people say. So, you know, and I'll admit that I flipped open my little book that have some of the things in there and things that people told me. You know, people may not remember exactly what you said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. Learn to become comfortable being uncomfortable. The enemy of good is not evil, it's perfection. Probably one of the best quotes that I've always remembered from, and I have used it ever since my early days at the basic school when I was a company commander, was Douglas Southall Freeman's quote, you know, probably the most succinct definition of leadership is know your stuff, take care of your men, and be a man. And again, you know, that covers everything. Never get too busy to lead. And then I guess a little bit of humor. How old would you be if you didn't know how old you are, Satchel Paige? Right?
I'll tell you what. I want to conclude this with a story. I'm an instructor at the basic school. We do a range called Range 5, which is essentially a golf course with some berms on it. And a piece of dirt that is the objective. It's cut out of the woods, so there's trees on both sides. And so I'm not sure if it was Elvis, I think it was Elvis Company, that Major Milstead at the time is commanding. And we have these pop-up targets. And so, Boomer and I go back to days of, like, I first met him, I think he came on a patrol with me. And we start talking, and we were having a good time, and we were navigating. And he's an Anglico guy, so he thought he could navigate, right? But Quantico is a quagmire. If you can navigate in Quantico, which is one of the great things about Quantico, if you learn to navigate there, you can navigate anywhere on the planet because you have no. So, yeah, words that you hate to hear as an instructor. All right, who's the navigator? I am, sir. All right, Lieutenant, what's your name? Lieutenant Elliot, sir. All right, how are we doing this? Well, sir, I like to dead reckon. Okay, we're not doing that today, okay? We're in a dead reckoning, and that's not, you're not that guy, okay, my friend? Because I don't dead reckon, and I work here. So let me tell you how we're going to do this, because I do intend to go home for dinner tonight. I'm not missing it again. So anyway, Boomer and I meet, and we navigate constantly. And I was always teaching him, and he was a good student. So we're out of range five, and we're, you know, and I come to him, and I said, hey, tell me if you want to do this. At the end of the day, I'll send up one of these targets, and you talk to your guys, and you put the rifle like over your shoulder, and shoot it, and don't shoot it in the ground. Shoot it down the range fan, and I said, and I'll knock the target out. And he starts laughing. He goes, all right. And then he says to me, he goes, hey, how about if I get like, I'll get one of the Marines to have a mirror. And I'm like, exactly. So tell the story from there. So he gets the whole company after this is over, right? They're in a school circle and he starts giving the speech. The speech of what I know it included, he pulls out one round and he says, boys or Marines or whatever he said, one bullet, one God, one wife, one shot, one kill. Right? So tell the story from there.
Well, and then I put the rifle over my shoulder, but I think if I remember, I put it over the wrong shoulder, so when it ejected the round, it hit me in the face. But anyway, so I do it, and then I say it's all in your mind. Or whatever, some other bullshit or something like that. But hell, I can't remember exactly. But all I do remember is I fired the round, and when I fired the round, Max in the tower, and he hits the switch, and the target flips down like I hit it, and the place goes nuts. Everybody just stands up and cheers and everything, and then I moonwalk around a little bit.
Then he moonwalks, right, and the lieutenants go crazy. The lieutenants go crazy.
I'd forgotten about that you mentioned that a while ago. Yeah.
No, it was funny. But you know what? It is one of those things where, you know what, boys, we can have a good time doing this. There's nothing that says we're going to be miserable enough. And having a little fun is not a bad thing.
No, it's not. It's not, you know, because the basic school, as I told them, I said, you know, the best view of the basic school is always going to be through your rearview mirror. But it's how we approach it and what we do day in and day out. You know, again, it goes back to that, you know, learn to become comfortable being uncomfortable, you know, lean into it and make the most of it. Have some fun. I guess that kind of is like a career, right?
No, without a doubt. Let me read you one more email, sir, and I'll let you go. Hey, Mac, I've listened on a number of occasions, and your guests are predominantly combat arms guys. And I just want you to know how heartened I am. I thought if there would be any kind of troglodytes in the Marine Corps that were resistant to women and the way women are treated, I thought it would be guys in your community. What I find seems to be the exact opposite. You guys seem to be more adamant and have a harder line, regardless of your intellectual position relative to women in infantry, women in tanks, women in artillery. You seem to intellectually separate that from the way women get treated, period, and I think that's very refreshing. I think a lot of times in the supporting arms, because we spend so much more time with females in our unit, we have kind of a little bit different attitude. You guys seem less tolerant of this stuff, and I think the Marine Corps needs a healthy dose of that less tolerance. It'll be interesting. I am encouraged by what I hear from the various Marines that you bring on the program, because by what they say, they have no tolerance. If you want to prey on one of my Marines, male or female, you're going down, and it's not going to be pretty. I love that. Thanks for what you do. Enjoy the program. And I agree with the previous emailer in terms of you simply do not hear this discussed in a long format in any other place. So I would tell you, that's pretty that sentiment relative to if you prey on a Marine, you're going down. I mean, I would say that's a no-brainer. And it did, but I will tell you, I don't know if it is because I didn't spend a lot of time in non-combat arms units. But I know the tolerance that my peers would have for that kind of nonsense, and that is that bullshit is not happening. It's not happening.
Well, you know, I think, and it goes to the point of the earlier comment. I mean, how long have we been talking? What?
2 hours.
2 hours? 2 hours?
Yep.
Yeah, ten, whatever. However long. Probably over half of it has been on this subject. And I think that it deserves that kind of time and that kind of attention. And hopefully we can fix this and put it behind us and press ahead to our next crisis, which we undoubtedly will have, but hopefully they become fewer and less significant.
All right. Well, first of all, Boomer, I hope we could do this again. I mean, I throw roundtables together and would love to have you on to talk leadership or whatever the topic of the day is, and you'll come back because, first of all, I've always enjoyed your humorous style and then the ability to be good and be tough and all of that. And I appreciate you coming on and doing this morning. I think it's important that, you know, Marine voices, especially loud ones, from the rank that you achieved, I think it's important that they be heard. That, you know, we don't flinch from this stuff, and we'll take the face shot, and we'll keep moving, and we'll be better. And so I appreciate you very much for you coming on today.
Hey, well, thanks, Mac. You know, and given, you know, the kind of folks that you have on this, I consider it an honor. You know, I mean, it's because again, you know, it's the young Marines. It's the Marines that made me stick around for 40 years, and they deserve better, and they deserve our leadership, and they deserve our support. And, you know, so hopefully we'll just grab a hold of this. And I'll tell you, and I think you'll agree with me, Commandant Neller will very quickly find this, and he will crush it. He's not a guy to be reckoned with.
No, and he was my battalion commander at 3rd LAR. And
you were his favorite company commander.
that's true, as a matter of fact. He'll joke about it, but he knows. All right, he knows. But he tweeted over the weekend to female Marines, "I've got your back."
Okay. And they can take that to the bank.
Take that to your grave and the bank and any other place you go. Because let me tell you, he is a straight line guy. If he thinks it, he'll say it, right, sir?
That's right. That's right. That's right. And he'll fix it. So we'll all fix this. I mean, he can't alone, but we all got to get behind him, and we need to go back to that, what that one Marine said in her email. You know, we desperately need your help. That needs to be in neon lights.
All right, sir, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Mac. Always a pleasure.
Bob Milstead right there. Otherwise known as Boomer. Thank you.
You ruined me now.
You'll always be Boomer. Thanks.
Bye.
There you have it. Lieutenant General, how about that? No, he's a great guy. And the combination of humor, intellect, and toughness never gets old in the Marine Corps. Never gets old in the Marine Corps. It never gets old in leadership. But the challenge, huge. In terms of this issue, and as you, I think as you can see, as you discover more about the demographics of the Marine Corps, it's a problem that it's not like you're going to deal with it and it's going to get better. You have to deal with it every day because you have more and more young people that come in every day, and then people that leave. So it's almost like you're doing steady state operations on this issue. It's this daily constant fight for it. But I don't think the Marine Corps and the United States military has been adamant and clear enough about it. That's why I think there needs to be a specific article in the UCMJ that deals essentially with that. Because as we raise the bar on performance, they need to know, hey, if you do this, if you transmit an image, you will be punished. You can be charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Okay? that, but again, there's legal issues that go with that, okay, that are not Marine Corps centric. There's legal issues that go with that. If you send that to me, whose property is it? Did you give that to me? If you gave that to me, then that becomes mine, yes? Is that settled law? So, you know, so again, so we're not talking about something that somebody stole from you. We're talking about something that you gave to them. So, again, there's legal issues, and I'm not a lawyer. I mean, sometimes I play one on the radio. But we'll continue to look into this issue, again, as we explore it. Anyway, my thanks to Boomer Milstead. We're going to take a quick break. More of Almarine Radio on a Wednesday coming up next.
Hi, Josh Groomer, General Manager at PS Garage Doors. Customers often ask me, what does the PS stand for? Prompt service. Winter weather can cause problems like your garage door not opening or you and your car being stuck outside in the cold. For fast and reliable service, call 772-DOOR. PS Garage Doors is always ready to react to whatever snowball winter throws at your door. We are here to keep your door running all winter long. For your convenience, we offer 24-hour local emergency service in the Grand Forks area. PS Garage Doors, for all your garage door needs, call 772-DOOR or visit us online at psgaragedoors.com.